listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got the one and only Bobby Osinski. Bobby.
Hey, Mike. Hi, guys.
Next to him, we have a long-lost member, Scott Gershon. Scott.
Hello.
And joining us all the way from Philadelphia, we've got the one and only, I miss LA, Rob Arbiter. Rob.
Hey, everybody. Yeah.
It should be Cyber Rob.
Do you miss LA?
It is. Skyping in late at night here in Philly, it's not the easiest thing, but I got to keep the streak alive.
You have to keep the streak alive. And today, we are truly honored with our guests. We have first of all, you know, we get guests that I'm like, oh, yeah, that's really cool. And then we get guests where I'm like, this is really cool. And this is one of those, this is really cool moments, because we got two guys that are part of music history, really, when you think about it. We've got Lloyd Trammell. Lloyd.
Hello, everybody.
And John Gould.
Hi, guys.
And just to give you a little background, you know, we're going to be talking about their company and what they're doing now. But Lloyd was founder of Voice Crystals. That was one of the premier third-party sound companies back in the day, and patches. Odds are, if you were in the late 80s, early 90s, you had sounds by either one of these gentlemen, because John was involved with Centaur that did sounds for Insonic, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So it's truly an honor to have you guys here at the Audio Nowcast. Just want to let you know. I am giddy. So we're going to be talking about that, what they're doing in the past and the present, and all kinds of stuff. But before we go there, we're going to start with with a little controversy that our own Bobby Osinski was kind of brought into, and that's the big rumor going around about Logic and Logic being dumped and Apple getting rid of the European developers and that whole thing. Bobby, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there's a rumor going around, although I took it as fact because it came off of the Macworld website.
Right.
And basically it was that that Apple had let go all of their Logic developers. And in fact, there's only two people left, and they were product people, product specialists. So I happened to post that on my website last week on the Big Picture production blog.
Right.
The blog, not the website. And there was a huge pushback, much more so than I've ever experienced. It was filled with Apple and Logic fanboys, and I had to say, wait a second, I'm one of you guys. I don't use Logic, but, you know, I don't want to see it go away either.
You know, it was really innocent. I read your post, and it was like you were basically stating what, you know, what was fact. It's not anything other than stating what was happening, and you were asking the question, you know, is this the end for Logic?
Well, usually what I do is I'll quote a website or a story. I won't just take it, copy and paste it. I'll take it and put my own spin on it. And in this case, that's what I did. I said, gee, it would be a shame if it went away.
Absolutely.
And I don't want it to happen, but here are the things that seem to be happening. And, you know, too bad if it goes away. And just pointed to all the facts that perhaps it might, because, you know, Apple has been moving towards consumer products, and they're looking more towards the iPad than they are anywhere else these days, because let's face it, they make a lot more money that way. So that's what I reported, and I was taken to task.
Yes. I mean, well, you were linked through an article through Syntopia, which was linked to an article in Create Digital Music, I believe.
And oh, it was all over. Yes,
yeah.
It was on all every forum you
could
think of.
Everybody was linking and going back, and they were all
Won't the proof in the pudding be that at the NAMM show?
Yeah, the NAMM show will be a good litmus test for this whole thing. But I think what was amazing is what you kind of got – what you alluded to was the storm that happened, and how, you know, you can attack someone's family. You can attack, you know, And you won't get as much emotion as you will get when you attack their DAW.
Oh, I had people that unsubscribed.
Unsubscribed?
Yeah, I had people that said, I will never read your blog ever again. I had.
Are you serious?
People call me all sorts of names. I've never had that kind of response.
Chill out.
And I never get involved when people make comments if they're negative. I just let it go. But in this case, I had to come back and I had to say, well, look, I'm just the messenger here, you know, and here's the sources. But I did update it today because there's some good information that perhaps it's not a true story and perhaps it's not something to happen.
I mean, I did a little bit of research and you get people, you know, seems like Pro Tools Expert, the blog kind of started a little bit and people were alluding to the fact that, hey, it's Pro Tools and so maybe they want to drop a bomb or something like that. I don't know. There's all kinds of speculation out there. But regardless, I think Scott's right. The proof's in the pudding is, you know, what happens at the NAMM show? What do they do? Where does it go?
Well, what I want to know is
they don't usually demo anymore at the NAMM show, do
right?
they?
No, they don't.
Do they have a logic booth, though?
Around that time, though. I'm not necessarily even saying at the NAMM show, but basically the proof will come if we see something come out. And then people are speculating, what is it going to be? Is it going to be like the Final Cut 10? Is it going to be a garage band version of Logic where they kind of dumb it down but make it a mass appeal for the masses?
Well, what I want to know is who exactly uses Logic? It's not Post, right? There's nobody in Post that uses it.
I always thought it was composers.
Composers, dance music, you know. I mean, it's your best bang for your buck. I mean, really, for the price that they charge for it and the amount of stuff that you get, it really is. It's if you're just breaking in, I know exactly why you want to go with Logic, because it's compatible with all the GarageBand stuff, all the loops, and you get a ton of stuff.
I always thought that Logic was priced lower and more competitive, not as much to sell it, but people are going to want to buy the latest Macs to support it.
Well, that's true.
So it's almost like a lost leader, because you buy the software, next thing you're going to do is buy a new laptop or a new desktop. But it might be that that's a business that they're not focused on as much. It might be more mobile technologies.
Well, and it sounds good. I mean, it's a good DAW. I mean, my problem that I have with it is kind of a little bit on some of the user interface and just some of the mechanics of working with it. But it's if you know that, you know, that DAW well, you can do some great stuff with it. And let's face it, it had convolution reverb added in when, you know, nobody was doing that kind of stuff.
I'm surprised a company hasn't looked at, almost like what an Avid did, Final Cut, Logic, and all of their pro software and say, I'd like to make a bid on that from Apple, because if they're not interested in it, that would be a very interesting play.
It might happen with the Avid and DigiDesign and Pro Tools.
You know, yeah.
I understand, actually, that there's companies that are kind of circling the wagon, you know, the vultures are out circling.
Nobody's doing really great. I mean, you look at Avid, I mean, their stock price is dropping.
In the toilet.
It's just tanking and tanking and tanking. Last time we talked about it, it was at $9. Last time I checked, it was down, you know, below $7. So, I mean, none of these guys are, like, doing terrific. I mean, they all could be doing terrific, but none of them are really doing that great. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
I think in the pro market, everyone who wanted one got one. So I think they've hit market saturation at this point. And until the next desktops come out or new technology takes you to another place, nobody has a reason.
Right.
I mean, Pro Tools like a tape machine. It works.
Yeah.
It does what it needs to do.
Although Pro Tools, I think they're just – they're all messed up, because I think their pricing structure is ridiculous. It's they're practically sending people to these other guys, because to get into Pro Tools HD for just delay compensation, it's going to cost you $2,000. You know, if you go from seven to ten, it's $2,000.
But in Post, there's no other solution. There's no viable.
Does anybody use Nuendo in Post?
No,
because they
try.
But the reason is it's really easy. It comes off the Avid or even Final Cut. Go straight into Pro Tools.
Not anymore with Final Cut, though. That's the crazy thing.
Well, no, but the old Final Cut. But nobody who I know is cutting films uses new Final Cut.
Exactly.
So even if it's the new Premiere, in other words, nobody wants to experiment with the latest, greatest. There's too much money at stake.
Yeah.
And but on the flip side, you know, there's less Post going on.
Right.
Did you guys see the new Nuendo console, the controller just came out called New Age?
Yeah.
Which yeah. looks very cool, oh, actually.
Nuendo looks, it totally looks
did,
cool.
Did you see that? It's a really nice work surface that it looks kind of like a Euphonics. And it's priced a little high. It's between, I think, 18 and 30 grand. But it looked pretty cool. It interfaces very well. Multiple screens, you know, just like Euphonics.
Yeah.
Looked pretty cool. Just came out.
I think I think there's opportunities now. I think that if somebody said, hey, I've got another alternative that's made for games and post and that post world, I think it'd be ripe for the next generation. But it can't be like, well, I'm a post guy, but let me show you what we do with kick drums.
Yeah, right.
You know, because that's what happened in the past. They go, yeah, you can kind of use it. But all the guys that were demoing it
had
no clue about post.
What is the next generation? What would you want that you don't have already?
I know.
Yeah?
I don't mean to interrupt you, Scott, but right off the bat, I think what's the next generation is you're going to see things folded in that we take for granted right now. For instance, if you want like a uber smart EQ that will ride the EQ values.
Oh, like a dynamic EQ.
Exactly. Yeah. But really smart, you know, so you could say, here's your parameters, kind of like a vocal writer that they have with Waves,
yeah.
but with like EQ, that type of stuff. I mean, it's going to get a little smarter, a little more independent on doing specific things like that. And then you're still going to be able to do the big picture.
Okay, you're saying so that there'll be more things built in that now we use as plugins.
Exactly. But yeah. but even so, even more automated things. But it's kind of what we were talking about last time when we talked about the touch interface, right? If you start automating some of these stuff and then have different ways to interact with them, with touch consoles and screens where you do gestural changes and things like that, that are only possible because the computer and the software is taking care of all the minute little details.
Yeah.
Then I think.
And I'll update that with two things that I think that Pro Tools can evolve into. First thing is everything's online. So in other words, he's doing a mix, you got two editors feeding it, they're all feeding it to the same session. We can kind of do that a little bit now, but not quite. So now what happens is you can have six people all working on the same, or they could be working on a virtual surface that's all on a server. So nothing's local, number one. Number two, Pro Tools is kind of like a dumb console. In other words, you got inserts. You put a plugin in, and it inserts that sound within that track. But I want them to connect. I want one plugin to talk to another plugin.
Right.
I want to have like a modular synthesizer of plugins.
More so than sidechain, you know?
And even sidechains, right. It's kind of tickles the area.
Right.
But it doesn't really go there. So I want to make it where if I have a sound, it automatically knows I changed my reverb.
Mm.
So it's not – right now it's kind of dumb audio. It's very old school
right. In
a computer. But let's have it be smart. It needs to say, hey, I just noticed – you took your reverb from 2 seconds to 4 seconds, and you've got a decay like this. So now all of a sudden, the plugins are talking to the computer,
yeah. And
there's a whole logic scheme going yeah. In. And then I could sit there and say, I'd like a modulation piece, or whether it's even in music. I want to put a tempo down, everything's syncing to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so you can basically go in, link different plugins together, and also have module plugins.
Yep.
Well, there's a lot of cool things you could do.
I think on that note, I'm looking at a more object-oriented environment.
Interface.
For instance, if you have that giant touch screen, right, why can't I have objects and why can't I throw my effects literally around? If I want to do some type of really cool pan, why can't I have an object representing that sound and I can flick it and add velocity and add space to wherever I want it to go just by flicking? I mean – can you imagine the random coolness you could have on like gunfights, right? If you could have each little bullet and you're flicking, boom, 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 you're flicking it and it's sending the sound where you're going on the flick, where you have a little dot that represents that sound.
It's
that kind of stuff.
What you're talking about is taking the controllability and versatility of synthesis and now put it into a mixing paradigm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now it used to be, you know, where one was called an envelope and the other one was called a gate. And, you know, you go back and forth, and they're similar, you know, different names, same technologies.
And I think we have to cross that barrier, because that's the only way we're going to get into controllers that are going to be non-fader centric desks. I mean, if you can break out your sound into an object, there's no reason why not only touchscreens, but you could use like an orb and have your hand and move it in dimensional space, and that is where the sound goes. Well, especially with things like Atmos.
But even like light, you're talking like even with the light beam, I always think that there was always two different groups, whether it, even in music and even in post. There's mixers, and I'm going to call them sound creators, the people that generate sound, and then they give it to a mixer. But those two worlds have kind of barely touched. And I think now with the iPad, and first of all, I've seen iPads become the brains of mixers. And now all of a sudden, mixers are going to go, like you said, can I have it as a panner?
Yeah.
Just simple. Let's start with the low-hanging fruit. Give me an iPad to pan. Then when we're talking to things, whether it's 7.1 or 5.1 or even Atmos, now all of a sudden you're giving a certain amount of flexibility for mobile technologies. And once that happens, now all of a sudden, can I do automation on it? Can I do an EQ? Can I do a compressor, et cetera, et cetera?
You guys can jump in.
Yeah.
I'm waiting.
Don't wait. Well, you got to jump.
Actually, a lot of the things you're talking about,
right,
I saw in the mid-90s. That was done with balloon shapes.
Right.
And you could do all the things you're saying right now. You could do this in the mid-90s. But because nobody would accept a paradigm shift,
right,
is what it was. Because nobody would accept it. They all just went, oh, no, this is no good. So in 6 months, it was dead.
You know? I mean, I remember in going to the NAMM show and seeing some of the virtual 3D audio where you had like the little balloon and you can make it, you know, you spread your choir and you make the red oblong shape a little longer if you wanted to have more space or a little shorter.
Just for effects, mixing, everything.
I mean, the light beam, I mean, I did True Lies, I don't know how many years ago that was, where the whole Harrierjet, I had a light beam and all my EQ moves were being done by my hand over the light beam.
But I think...
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But I think nowadays what's making it is technology. Back then it was cutting edge and you felt like you were kind of pushing the machine. But now technology has caught up and we have so much power that... And the prices have gone down too. I mean, let's face it. You know, when you can get... You can get Logic for $300 and get all that stuff. It's just I just think it's a different time. I think we're more receptive seeing the iPads come out and the phones come out and some of the new software. But you're right, it's none of this stuff is necessarily new, the idea. It's just now how we're going to implement that.
And I think it's what people get used to, because you had faders and then people used to joke that people mix on a mouse. Why? Because it was an interface that people got really fast and they got used to, and they had a trackball. Well, now they got, you know, a piece of glass.
Yeah.
And they're used to navigating on that piece of glass. So it only is logical that that next generation of people go, well, can I use that piece of glass?
Yeah.
You know what's funny? In 1982, I worked for AMIC, the console company, for a while. And George Massenberg came on as a consultant on some projects. And George came up with the idea of glass mixing in 1982, and he had it all sorted out, how, you know, without faders and everything. This is 30 years ago.
Yeah. It's I mean, I just think, you know, all in all, I think we're ready for some new stuff. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But I think the one thing that we can learn through this whole thing is, Bobby, you should never piss off the fanboys at
all.
You know what would be nice, though, also? Are you able to use multiple touchpad surfaces? I mean, can you imagine putting 4 or 5 iPads together?
Oh, you know what? You already can. You can. I got the iPad mini, and I've got my big iPad, and you can absolutely lock them together with no problem. Korg makes the Wisp, where basically you can sync. And with AudioBus that's coming out, which right now will be able to send stuff within your iPad, but they're working on versions where you can have one iPad and then other people can send their audio to you. I mean, it's coming down. That's coming down the pipe right now. It's pretty exciting what's happening in the iPad world.
Hey, Rob, you're pretty quiet.
It's pretty late here.
Rob hasn't missed a podcast, but he didn't say he was going to talk on the podcast.
Exactly.
Well, what
it's
do
like
you think?
Max headroom here.
What do you think about what the new DAWs or the next generation of a DAW should be? What are we missing?
I think what we're missing is someone willing to take a chance, spend a ridiculously huge amount of money to develop something like we're all talking about that we would love. I mean, Pro Tools at this point is such an unwieldy code base that anything they add to it or fix can break 10 other things. It's kind of like trying to fix Windows at this point. It's a code base that you can't repair anymore. It's way too big. And I remember at NAMM shows seeing, you know, the guys who had the mixing on the screen where you'd see the pictures of the instruments,
right,
and you'd pick up the guitar and move it somewhere else on the stage instead of panning, and that would actually affect the EQ and compression and panning, but you would do it graphically. And all that stuff was cool in a different way of thinking. But
Line 6 has that now, their latest mixer.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
And they're the newest generation to do it, and they do it very well. But it's going to take something colossal happening at one of the big software companies like Avid.
You mean like people, Logic getting fired and everybody goes on face their own thing? But I didn't say that. He did.
but that kind of thing would force creativity because it would open up a huge hole in the market.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think right now people like what they know how to use, and there's a lot of inertia getting people to try new things. I mean, I could make a list of what I love and hate about any one of the DAWs out there because I use all of them. But I don't know. I think Steinberg has probably been the most willing to sort of think outside the box and try something new, even if it goes a little bit against what their architecture had been.
Right.
You know, it was a very healthy thing the few times they've rewritten Cubase from scratch and the Nuendo code base and all that. From a development point of view, that was a very healthy thing to do. Pro Tools has never done that.
Right.
You know, there's still some legacy code, just like with Windows. I guarantee you there's some stuff that was in Windows, you know, 386 or whatever. Maybe some software engineer fanboys are going to get on my case now. But, you know, there's a lot of legacy code, and that comes from trying to remain compatible with your older customers. Apple's pretty good at screwing the older customer and just saying, you know what, we have a cooler, newer way to do it, and your old stuff isn't going to work anymore. That annoys a lot of customers, but the truth is it's actually better for evolving a product.
Yeah.
Pro Tools has never done that. Logic hasn't really done that.
But maybe there's Logic will now. I mean, that's the rumor as well. It's the other one.
That would be a healthy thing. There's some legacy garbage in Logic that's among the reasons why I don't like it. And it could use an overhaul. If new engineers could take the workflow that people love and actually do a modern piece of code around it, it could be an amazing thing. But Logic is a really tangled mess of patches and add-ons, and you can tell I've been spending the last few months as a software developer.
Well, go ahead.
That's my thought. I mean, my feeling is all of these programs, I've learned to use the key commands and the workflow. So if they could fix the engine to get rid of a bunch of the bugs and still have the workflow be the same,
right,
that's what I would love.
But it'll be interesting to see where it goes. I mean, it's you know, Logic looks like it's going to be around. In what version, what form, we don't know. But, you know, they're spending a lot of time, and a lot of sources are saying, no, we're not. So, like you said, the proof will be what comes out.
You know, the thing about Logic, again, is Apple doesn't tell anybody anything.
Right.
So, you know, the best you can get is yes or no out of them.
Yeah.
And even then you're lucky.
Yeah.
I wouldn't read anything into whether or not you hear much about them at NAMM, because they don't really react to trade shows anymore.
Yeah, yet. And I'm not even using NAMM literally. I'm just basically as just next year, you know.
The new Mac Pro is supposed to come out in January at Macworld. So you wonder if maybe there'll be something around there, because that would be the perfect time. You know, new tower, new
well, if they, yeah, if they want to keep the pros excited, they've got to do new pro hardware and software to run on it.
Yep.
I mean, they screw things up so much with Final Cut that everybody's a little bit leery.
Oh, yeah. Final Cut just did a ton of people in, you know. It's you don't see any facilities.
Maybe Google will invest in a new platform. You
know? All right. Well, hey, listen. We are going to take a break, and we're going to actually apologize to all the fanboys that Bobby offended. But no, but before we go, I have to say this. Guys, chill out, okay? It's just a program.
Let me throw this out there. Do you want to be a fanboy or a truth boy?
And yes, that's true. And also, if somebody attacks any tool that you work with, it's just a tool and they're not really attacking, you know, a little criticism, you know, a little self-evaluation. Maybe it's time, if you work on Logic, you should look at other DAWs. And if you don't work on Logic, give Logic a look, you know, but just don't take it personal. And for goodness sake, don't unsubscribe and send me letters and all that.
You know what? Amen.
If you only use one DAW now, you should explore what else is out there too. It's not a good thing to just use one because it's the only one you know.
Absolutely. I mean,
you should always keep an eye out.
I've still got my opcode working, so.
Hey, you know what? That's
Video Vision?
Rob makes a good point, though. I mean, most of the guys that I know that are making a living doing this in whatever capacity, whether it's a songwriter, sound designer, whatever, they usually have more than one tool in their tool chest. So just remember that. All right, well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to visit with Lloyd and John because they've been awfully quiet. They've got a lot to say. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were apologizing to fanboys for Bobby Osinski. No, we were talking a little bit about the whole, you know, is Logic going away? Is it here? What's going to happen? But, you know, let's go back. Let's go back before that. Back in the day, they had these things that were called
horses,
synthesizers.
Carriages.
Where you had keyboards and knobs and you had little cartridges that you could insert, and you could either use the stock sounds or you could use third-party sounds. And one of the big boys back in the day was a company called Voice Crystal. And we are honored to have Lloyd Trammell from Voice Crystal here with us. He's going to be talking a little bit about what he's up to now. But Lloyd, we got to talk about the history. And then John was working with Centaur, and we got to talk a little bit about that, because when I found out where Lloyd was from, I was giddy, because I remember back looking at keyboard magazines and looking at all the different sounds and all the different. Tell me a little bit about Voice Crystal, how you started, all the work that you did back with all the major synth companies back in the day.
Well, it was kind of an accident. I used to play in bands and stuff in Houston, where I'm from. And there was this one keyboard player named Peter Nero, and he had a Mini Moog. Didn't know how to make a sound on it to save his life. So he used to pay me to come up there to his gigs, and sometimes even during the song, walk up on the side of the stage and change the controls on his Mini Moog while he was playing. So, you know, I learned to do all the cool patches and stuff on that. Then we started having programmable synthesizers.
Right. Now, you're talking like the Juno 106 days or even before?
Before.
Like the Krumars back in those days?
Around that time, yeah.
Okay.
I think the first one that really was kind of cool was the Korg Poly 61.
Okay.
I liked that one a lot. So we did a lot of cool stuff with that, and that's about the time that I used to make two Commodore 64s, use serial commands, and play every synthesizer I have, and play every drum machine I have all in sync, and be able to change where they went to. It's just voltages and serial commands. It was easy for me. And the rep from Korg was down in Houston. He went to one of my friend's stores and said, hey, we got this new thing called MIDI. It's really cool. It's going to be able to let all these synthesizers talk to each other and stuff. And he goes, oh, yeah, we got a friend that does that. He said, no, you don't understand. It's drum machines can talk to each other and stay in time and play these parts, and you can change them just in the computer. He goes, oh, yeah, we got a friend that does that. Everything he said, he just tell him, yeah, we got a friend that does that. So finally, they brought him to my house that night. I showed him the stuff, what I could do with two Commodore 64s, because really we only had 34K RAM to work with. Not 64, 34K. It was archaic. So I talked to him that night, and we had dinner and stuff and hung out, and it was pretty fun. The next day, I got a call from a man named Kim Holland. at Korg US, and he offered me a job, and we started working on MIDI, and I just kept working on synthesizers and more of this and more of that. And we built Mark had the idea, him and I don't remember the other guy's name, Paul Chastain, mm-hmm. Who's passed away now. Mm-hmm. God bless his soul there. They came up with this idea to make something for Insonic because the ESQ was just about to come out and they liked it a lot. So we made this little cartridge that had an LED in it and had enough memory in it to store one set of patches. That started Voice Crystal.
That was the crystal for Voice Crystal.
That's why they call it crystal. Because it lit up. It was cool looking. You know, nobody had ever seen anything like
this.
Right, there wasn't anything like it to begin with. So we kept doing more and more synthesizers and more companies. And next thing you know, all the companies are coming to us saying, well, we need SoundROM. So we created SoundROM for everybody. And at the same time, they said, well, you made the ROM, make the patches. So I used to have prototypes for almost every synthesizer you could think of.
So tell me some of the synths that you worked on. I mean, so you're talking, let me see, if we're like the mid to late 80s, right, early 90s. So that's around the JD 990s, and that's around the Juno 106. Juno 106.
Oh, before.
Really?
Did you get into the DX7 world?
Right. Well, you're cool.
I hate DX7s. But they sounded cool. It took a long time to figure out how to do FM synthesis.
Absolutely.
But I'd already learned a lot about additive synthesis before that, so it kind of was something.
JX3P.
I did some things on that.
Okay.
I think the first really cool Roland thing I did was Jupiter 8. Right.
Jupiter 8, wow.
Then we did Jupiter 6, the MKS stuff, the D-series, I mean,
the Super
JXs. Well,
D50, so then M1, would that be around
the M-series for Korg, and the N-series, the O-series, I mean, lots of that stuff.
O1W, oh man, I mean, some of the classics.
Oberheim OB-8s, Prophet 5s, I mean.
Did you do any like CZ-101s or Fuzzies?
CZ-101! Wow.
Yeah. But you know, it was really cool.
Yeah.
It was cool. It had its own sound.
No, yeah, it was a big, fat, I remember, actually I'm going to go way back, but actually for a very, very short time worked at Guitar Center. And I remember this Casio rep came in.
Jerry?
I don't remember. He said, by the way, we got a Casio keyboard. And we're all like, yeah, okay, whatever. You know, I'm going to get my watch. And he plugged it in, this little keyboard, and big sound came in, very Oberheimish almost. And we were like, what's that? And everyone went, you know, and it was great. And we were like, wow, Casio's in the music business in a big way. And then they went away in a big way. The CZ1, the Fuzzy One. Right.
The SC1, the VZ1.
Yeah.
Now, let me interrupt really quick because up at this time, then, John, you were involved with synthesis back then, right?
In fact, when he brought up the Casio, I published a book of patches for the CZ101.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And then you worked on some of the later Korg stuff, right? The Triton and the Trinity.
When I was with Centaur, we had – Korg sent us what they called the silver box, which was just literally a silver box, you know, just a rack piece kind of thing that didn't really have any controls on the front of it. And they sent us some development software for us to help produce the ROM and to write patches for it. And did it all on, of all things, a Mac Centris 650, ran the program.
Man.
Wow. And, we developed all the patches for it in that, and also some of the arpeggiation things,
right,
that were included in that board.
Let me ask you, what was the best sound set that you ever came up with? Do you remember? Do you have one that you look back and you go, "I love those sounds"?
For the Korg stuff, or
anything? I'm gonna let you go because I'm gonna ask you the same thing, Lloyd. So
I developed a set of drum sounds for Insonic that were based on another company's device on the SP drums from EMU that were more affected sounding than the stuff in the SP and kind of directed for the kids that were coming up doing the rap and hip hop stuff.
Right. What about you, Lloyd? What was your favorite from back in the day?
Must be the Korg Wave Station.
Really?
I made awesome patches.
Those were fantastic.
For the ones we sold at Voice Crystal were just killers.
Did you work on any of the stock sounds, or did you just did yours?
Worked on some of those with there's another guy, I think his name was Ben Dowling, that did the majority of them.
Right.
But Athan Bilius was in charge of all that stuff. Right. He put a whole bunch of my stuff in there.
There's some the wave station.
I've still got my wave station. It is pristine.
I'll tell you what, I was telling before the podcast, I was telling John and Lloyd this story. But when I was first starting out as a keyboard tech, I was working with Natalie Cole, and the keyboard player had a wave station. And I used to love to sound check on that wave station. And I thought, if I ever got to the time where I, you know, had some money, I just want to get you have that one like ego purchase, that one purchase that you want to buy because it's kind of your way of saying, okay, you've kind of done well. And I was going to get that keyboard. And years later, I was in Guitar Center and they had a used one. And I asked how much, and it was $400.
Yeah.
And I bought it, $400. And it's like, I still have that keyboard. And it's like, it's my favorite piece of gear because just for what it represents, but also, come on, it's a wave station. That's such a great keyboard, you know? And it was the whole wave and vector-based, you know, programming. And I was just – it was amazing. Although I will say that sync-wise, sometimes I have issues with the sync on that thing. That's what I like about the software version. It never goes out of sync. But you know what? It's alive. There's something about that keyboard that's just – it's really cool. It's a great keyboard. But – anyway, so the wave station, the sounds that you did for that are probably the stuff that you're the most proud of.
Yeah. That's my baby.
What do you guys think of, like, the newer software synths and the newer sound engines?
Camel Audio and yeah. That kind of stuff.
One thing that I've noticed, and we had this discussion the other day with some other keyboard players and sound people, is a lot of the in-the-box synths in those devices have an overtone to them, to my ears and a couple other people that we've talked to, that seems consistent from one to the next. And, you know, I don't know if it's something from being in the box and not being its own synth or, you know, you're turning a computer into something that it's not really designed to do when you're, you know, building a synth inside the box, basically.
Rob, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, the faster computers get, the better the simulations can be. We've had all the conversations in the past about, you know, digital trying to recreate analog, and I still just think it's not there yet. You know, it's still an approximation of a sound rather than an actual sound to me.
Isn't it true, though, again, if you look at just pure the sampling rate of digital, and you can just think of it as resolution, the higher the sample rate, the closer to analog you get? So yeah, the higher the resolution of digital, the closer to analog? And
absolutely. But the thing is, it's not just about the higher sample rate. You basically...
Yeah, I understand that, but I'm just making a kind of a comparison that... perhaps might work. I guess it does.
No, it does. It does. It's just that the higher sample rate lets you represent a sound better, but the thing that they're still improving is the modeling of all the harmonics within the sound.
Yeah.
There's a lot of complex math that they never used to be able to do that they're starting to be able to with faster and faster DSP now. And the higher sample rates can then perform the sound, but they're still working on the models that can approximate what actually happens in nature.
Yeah.
It's getting close.
What's even interesting, because I just started getting into UAD plugins, and I've been very impressed with what they're doing. But it's interesting when you take, let's say, 1176 or an LA2 knockoff on a cheaper plugin, and then you do it to a higher-end plugin who's got a little more DSP and they're really working it a little bit harder. There's a difference.
There's
not as subtle.
But it also works the other way around. There's some keyboards that you have fond memories of that if you listen to today, you're like, man, that sucks.
That's true too.
I mean, the one I already mentioned, like the JX3P, you're right? Back in the day, I thought it was the fattest, warmest keyboard I ever heard. And And now when I play it, it's
fuzzy.
yeah. It's like, you know what? Oh my goodness.
Also, there are synths that sound great on their own, but that doesn't mean they're going to sound great in a track.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And like the Roland MKS-70 was one of those to me. I loved the sound of it as a synth module. And it was the same. I forget which keyboard it was the same as, but they had a keyboard version of it as well. But I could never get that thing to sound right in a track.
Yeah.
It was great on its own, but unless it was going to be featured, it just didn't layer well. And there's a lot of the subtlety in the sound that figures, you know, how it's going to play in the track.
Yeah, and then there's also the reverse. There's the sounds that don't sound that great on their own, but work great in a track. And I'll tell you one was the MKS-20 piano. By itself, it wasn't really a piano. It was an approximation of a piano, but in a track, it was a piano. I mean, it played well with others, you know.
I have a question for you guys. So you have experience with more keyboards than most people. What was your favorite?
God, that's a tough question.
I love them all.
That's like saying what's my favorite.
Is there one that you didn't like that was just a pain in the ass?
Synergy. There's lots of stories about that one.
Oh gosh. I'd have to say least favorite as far as that end of it, Polymoog.
Because it never stayed in tune, or
that was never. Tuner's nightmare, man.
Just general power supply issues that would cause failures and out of tuneness and
but the sound of
sounded great when it was working and everything was the motor was churning and going. It was great, but
the Polymoog could change its sound depending on how long you had it on too.
Right.
I mean, you would start a day sounding like one thing and you would end a day sounding like something else. So that was
Did you guys ever get into Chroma? Any of those?
I want to hear about the Chroma.
In fact, he still had one up till just a few years ago.
It was an extremely cool instrument, but it was too expensive and too hard for the normal person to program. Yeah. And the sounds that they put in it to sell them were very esoteric. So it was just a hard sell for a store.
What is the? Is there like a new synth that you really dig?
Yeah, the Korg Kronos.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
It's bad.
Do you guys do any work with it or on it or for it, or you just enjoy it?
We just like it.
you know what? That says a lot. I mean, coming from you guys, that says a lot. I will have to pay more attention to that. Writing it down.
If it's okay, I want to go back to the
absolutely the
Logic and Cubase thing. I'm just curious if anybody out there – I've heard this story ever since the 80s. That the guy that wrote Cubase and the guy that wrote Logic were roommates, and it was kind of a contest. Yeah. Have you heard that before?
Yeah, Rob?
Yeah, I've heard. I'm not sure if they were roommates or friends, but yeah, I have heard some variation of that story.
Because I thought, weren't they all C-Lab before all that?
Yeah, that's the part that was always confusing to me. They all were related to C-Lab somehow, but I don't remember how.
Sounding old. But yeah, I thought there was C-Lab, and then I always thought C-Lab split, and one became Steinberg, and one became...
Whatever the parent company for Logic was
at
the time.
Yeah, E-Magic.
And that was like, and then one was Atari-based.
Right.
You know, because I know that Steinberg was always Atari-based.
Right, that was...
Because I remember...
Cubase was more Atari.
Because I was a clinician showing C-Lab on a Commodore 64, and then I remembered Steinberg said, hey, we're coming out with an Atari computer... And then everyone looked towards the Amiga and said, what's coming? So then it became the war of what's the best computer for musicians.
Right.
And then the Mac came up, but the Mac was so not friendly. Yeah.
It was Atari back in those days, though.
Because
I had the Amiga and Amiga. But the
Atari had MIDI in, timecode in. Yeah. I mean, it was like set up as a music device.
In the 90s, the early... all the Teddy Riley stuff, going back to early Guy and even Michael Jackson's Dangerous, all that stuff was Atari. That was on the Atari ST.
Right.
And because I had to convert Teddy Riley. I converted his studio from Atari to Mac.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting
My first DAW venture. Was sound designer on an Atari Stacy.
Yeah.
Which was their version
of a laptop. I still have a Stacy, by the way.
That's still have one that works.
We toured with four of them when I was working with Guy. Four of them, because they were not the best roadworthy computers.
But I used to do a lot of work with Hybrid Arts.
Right.
Hybrid Arts!
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I was one of the first ADAP users. And it was very heavy. And Frank Foster, a friend of mine, used to run Atari, or one of the main people.
Yeah.
And so I had all the Ataris, like probably two of everything. And it seemed like we were joking, because the moment they came out with a hit, you went, oh, my God, this is the coolest thing. They didn't distribute it. Then they come out with something going, this is not working so well. That they came out with. Because I remember they came out with a little, what is this thing called? It was a mobile video game. And it was great.
Yeah, the Lynx.
The Lynx.
Yeah.
And it blew away everybody.
California games on the Lynx.
Yeah, absolutely.
So much fun.
I still got it. And and the weird part is, you said, oh, my God, this will go viral. And you could put a cable and everyone could play against each other.
Yeah.
And this is back in, God, I don't know.
This was back in the 80s. Early, right. Late 80s, well, early 90s.
Right.
Because I had one when I was touring.
Wait, they now have it. It's a DS. But in those days, you said, this has got to come out. And then all of a sudden, they couldn't distribute it.
Yeah.
They just never came, came out en masse.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Well, hey, listen, I wanted to talk about what Lloyd and John are up to nowadays. But before we move on to what you're up to now, because it's some really exciting stuff, let me just tell you that, you guys, I mean, the amount of sound that you put out and the amount of records that your sounds are on is just probably just – inconceivable. And I just, man, you guys did some great work back then. And you were, a lot of times, a lot of the synths and a lot of the hardware was sold purely on the sound alone,
Sure.
Not too
probably
many people
still
knew,
is.
But sometimes you seem to get a lot of guys that are into the specs now and what it can do and stuff like that. But back then, you just could go up and hit the patch and hit the keyboard and right then and there, one patch could sell, $2,500.
The whole song was made on, program one, bank one, hit the key.
Yeah. And I think – but there was a certain amount of almost – I guess, for lack of a better word, reverence about those keyboards, because they were so expensive back then, and you really wanted to get the most out of it. So not only did you buy your synth, but then you wanted to start looking for sounds for your synth because you wanted to feed this thing.
Right.
And sometimes I think with some of the modular soft synths that we have today, you've got like hundreds of thousands of sounds that you just take for granted, and you don't know that every single one of those things has to get programmed. It's just so disposable. You think music is disposable? How about synth patches?
I think synth patches are responsible for whether a keyboard is successful or not.
Yeah, that's true.
Because how many synths have we seen that potentially are amazing?
For some reason,
they just don't sound good.
Yeah. A great
and the
example
other ones,
yeah. of that is. YK5.
Yeah.
It was a great keyboard.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But it didn't sell because it
had no sounds. Well, how about how many D50s do you think were sold because of the Fantasia patch?
Oh, tons.
I mean, all you had to do is just play that for somebody and the lights would go on and people would like, oh man, because that was like one of the first patches, one of the first keyboards, D50 that had that reverb and it was lush and it had, the pad that went on forever. So anyhow, I just, like I said, you guys did great work. I just want to thank you. And I remember, like I was saying, looking through Keyboard Magazine and seeing your ads and stuff like that. It was awesome.
Actually wrote an article on Lloyd at one point. He had a dog that he called Cujo, but it's in the article in Keyboard, it was Cujo the MIDI dog. Because Cujo used to hang out in where he'd do all his programming, and he had an office bedroom kind of thing set up at his place, and Cujo would always be in there with him.
That's awesome.
So if you had to program your own synth today, let's say if it's software-based, because let's go virtual.
Sure.
What would describe what that would be? Your dream synth.
They make it right now. The Korg Kronos.
Oh wow. Okay.
It does everything you can imagine. I'm serious.
And the user interface? Easier, or is it?
It's like all Korg's other stuff. You know, you got to dig in and find what it does. And but they also have an Apple and a PC version to help you edit it. So, you know, they do quite well with it.
Right.
Well, let's before we go, because we're running out of time, I want to, and that's a great topic. We got to bring that up again, so don't forget, because I've got some opinions on that. But we got to talk about MaxD and what you're doing now, because that is really exciting, especially from what I've heard. And why don't you explain a little bit about the MaxD process?
Well, okay, MaxD was kind of a brainchild that came from everything we've talked about up to this point, trying to make keyboard voicing sound better, just audio in general sound better, looking for ways, you know, because back in the early days, we didn't have the memory capacity in sampling devices. Right. How do you make a sample sound better without having to change memory? So we were looking for ways to manipulate the sound without changing the properties of the keyboard, because you couldn't go in and rewire anything. You couldn't go in and add memory, you know, because it was a fixed operating system and all these things. So that's kind of where Lloyd came in, and he's always been, and if you can't tell already, kind of an out-of-the-box thinker.
Right.
He has some background in physics along with the music stuff, and he came up with an idea of using a combination of phase manipulation and synthesis together. I'll let him.
All right. Okay, you've got me. Keep going.
so my first product became, in fact, I did it with Voice Crystal with our samples, and a man came up to me at the NAMM show and asked me how did I do that? I showed him this little box. I'll make it a short story here. We're from Texas, and we usually tell long stories. So, anyway, I showed him this box. He wanted it. He was from Hughes Tool Company. And I said they had an audio division. So I said, okay, well, you know, I was thinking, yeah, Hughes, they're not going to do anything with this. So I told him, I want this amount of money. Give me this amount of finished boxes, and I'll help you for this amount of time. The guy said, great, we'll do it. I got back to my home in Houston 2 days later, and all the money I'd asked for in a contract was waiting for me before I got there.
Wow.
Now, I didn't think anything about it because I got everything I'd asked for. I'm not the guy that sits around later and goes, man, they made $25 million and I only got $5,000 out of it. I'm not that guy. I got what I asked for. I was happy. That little one static box became the AK-100, which was a badass box in its day. Well, anyway, they became Hughes Audio, and then they became SRS, which just got bought by DTS. Right. And I'm fairly certain they still use that same core technology today. But as time went on, I kept thinking about dynamics. You know, I need to be able to change things dynamically and have things follow. And so I got involved in resynthesis when it first started, and very quickly found out that it would take a giant room full of synthesizers, computers, just to make four notes. So, you know, resynthesis didn't go anywhere because it just took too much power. But I didn't give up.
Can you define resynthesis?
It's analyzing phase, time, and frequency domains. And in our process, it recreates those dynamically in nanoseconds. Our process is that fast. It's nanoseconds.
So is it the same thing as like basically like additive synthesis? We're using sine waves to create complex harmonics to be able to resynthesize a sample?
No. But I did that. And that's one of the reasons why it was so memory and CPU intensive, because they used sine waves.
Yeah.
And I learned this from all the additive days.
Yes.
To do like a saw wave, right, it takes about 6 or 8 additive sine wave oscillators to do that.
Right.
And a lot of power behind them pushing them. So this process can look at something, analyze it, say, oh, I know what you're supposed to be, so let me recreate you really fast. In a nanosecond, it recreates that and restores all the stuff in there that, say, somebody has really mastered the heck out of something and squashed all your dynamics and your harmonic content. Our process will put all of that back in there. Didn't increase the file size or anything. So now that we've done that, it's cleared up a bunch of the phase anomalies that made the sound a little muddy in the first place. Then we give you some controls to change it, so we can manipulate how it sounds. We have a tube emulator in there that took me 2 years to build because I modeled it after a Macintosh tube stereo. Mm-hmm. I approached it different than any other company has. They look at it and say, here's this wave at this particular amplitude and this frequency. They put different waves in and see what comes out and say, oh, all we have to do is shape the wave like this. Well, I went and analyzed what happens when a bunch of waves come in. And they're all different in their phase relationships and stuff.
And it's always a complex waveform anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I figured out how to do that and do it really, really well. So, you know, like I said, it took me 2 years to model this thing just for the tube part of it.
Right.
So we model a Macintosh tube stereo very well, which that's the finest stereo in the world.
Sure.
After that, we give you some more controls and things to do to keep it warm and analog sounding too. If you want to have like... if you're electronica or rap or something, mm-hmm. you want to have the bass from hell in your music, I can give you bass from hell with no distortion, and you won't overload everything. But you can have bass from hell because of how it works. No psychoacoustic stuff because psychoacoustics are kind of like 3D to me. They're kind of how was a nice word to say this?
A parlor trick.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's a nice word. So as we recreate this stuff, we can take – And we have things like this on our website to show you. It's www.maxsound.com. And there's demonstrations on there where we have taken something that's 44.1, and then we compare it to going through our process and convert it to a 128 MP3, and we will have more harmonic content and definition and dynamic range than that 44.1 16-bit file did. But we're still 128 MP3. Nothing has changed except we've processed it.
Wow.
Now,
wait. Let me just jump in here for a second because I heard this a couple weeks ago. So there'd be a really, really squashed, Lloyd would play a squashed, dynamically squashed and data squashed video, for instance, you know, streaming video that just sounded like crap. Going through the process, all of a sudden, it sounds like you're there. I mean, it was really fantastic. An MP3.
Yeah.
And that's what he's saying. You listen to an MP3 at 128K, and then through the process, and it sounds better than 44.1 off the CD. And I mean, it sounds better. So there's something there that they're doing. These guys have figured out how to extract information that isn't there, but it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's I heard the demo.
Is it phase interpolation kind of stuff?
He did the demo.
A little bit of that.
Now, let me ask, you know, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but so the Mac sound, like Bobby was saying, you know, you take these MP3s, you make them sound amazing. What is that process? Is it a software? Is it a hardware box? Is it a
– At this time, it's software.
Okay.
We have an API that we're – in the process of licensing to some of the major companies in the world.
Okay.
Now the reason, one of the big reasons that I pushed the last 6 years or so of my life to do what we've done now is because everything is going to the internet. Everything.
Right.
And 128 MP3, that's the standard now. You know, you can do 44.24, you do anything you want, 96.24, 192.24. It doesn't matter. At the end user level, it's going to be 128 MP3. That's where the most downloads and the money comes from. And the internet is finite. It's not infinite like everybody thinks. So as it gets fuller and fuller, and now we have TV, this 3D on the internet, we're about to have 2K TV, which is like 10 times larger.
Yeah.
Won't be long. We'll have 4K TV.
Right. And I think actually one came out. Sony came out.
Yeah.
I saw one. It was on sale for $17,000 at Best Buy.
Okay.
For right now. So, it's the DX1, you know?
That's right.
So, you know, others, Rob.
Anyway, as everything gets to the internet and the infinite is, you know, finite in its size, what's going to suffer every time? The quality of the audio.
Yeah.
So with our process, the audio doesn't have to suffer. It can. You can go from your 44.1s down to 128 MP3, which is, what, 91% compression there?
Right. Yeah. Now, does it need, for the music, do you have to use a special player, or can it play off any player?
No, once it's on the music, it's right on there. You can play it on anything.
So you can use iTunes. You can use,
It's not an encode decode kind of thing.
Oh, okay. So it's actually embedded in the thing.
It's not a codec, yeah.
Right.
It's actually embedded in the file. It's on the file. It'll play back in your car. It'll play back with the sonic qualities.
It's an encode thing.
And once it's on there, when you're, we'll say that we're here at Fox. We do our movie. We're sending it up to a satellite. It goes to another satellite. Comes down to Comcast. Okay, once it gets to Comcast, it goes to somewhere else. Then it goes somewhere else and somewhere else. It gets compressed every time it hits one of these places before it gets to your house.
Right.
It'll have about 95% of what it started with at Fox when it gets to you with our process, because our process is protecting it.
Rob, did you want to say something?
No. Oh. Just listening.
Now, I saw him put his hand.
We saw your hand go up, Rob.
Just stretching.
Okay, just again. So you know, we are watching you.
Okay, well, that's good.
But
here,
isn't it like 6 in the morning where you are, like 12 hours later?
Right.
So,
quite that bad.
So is it a process that anybody can, software you can buy, or do we have to license it? How do we get our music maxed?
Very soon we're going to have it up on our website where you'll upload your song. You'll get, there'll be like 3 levels. You'll get like 3 or 4 controls on the first level, and it's like 50 cents or something to do a song.
Right.
So you'll be able to adjust your song the way you want. If you want more controls, then you pay a little more. You want a little more controls, you pay a little more.
That's not a bad business model.
And you'll have 90 seconds to adjust your song, and then it'll ask you if you like this, do you want to pay for this?
So you haven't thought of like licensing it to Dolby and ask them for X amount of pennies per...
Not Dolby, but there are major companies right now.
I'm thinking from the film side, license that out, boom, get a piece of that action.
We're in discussions for that kind of thing.
Yeah. But, the model you have, though, makes so much sense because it empowers the quote-unquote little guy to be able to take advantage of this. I mean, if you license it out to a bigger company, they're going to just stick it in a box and put a bunch of zeros behind it.
But even if we license it to another company, we're still going to have the one for the common musician. Okay. Because you know how many common musicians there are in the world?
Yes, there are a lot of them.
In the United States, there's maybe 10% of what there is in the world.
And Bobby's pissed off like half of them.
According to a Berkeley study that just came out, there's fewer than there's ever been, actually.
Really?
Berkeley study just came out. Berkeley College of Music, why they do this, I don't know. But they found out that the number of musicians are decreasing.
You know what? I would say that that's probably true as musicians, but I bet you the number of people making music has increased. Because not all those people making music are musicians.
Ah, okay.
Look at every computer you buy, every phone you get,
good,
every tablet you have, there's music programs. And speaking of phones, we do have... If you go to Google Play, we have an app you can download.
Yeah, I saw that.
If you go, we'll have one pretty very, very soon for Apple. Right now it's for Android. All you have to do is go to Google Play and do a search for Liquid Spins, which is our music company.
Right.
And just download the app. It kicks butt.
But that's a light version, not to be confused with what we use for.
Right.
I will say though that I heard the files. Well, actually, I went to the just like you can out there. You can go to maxsound.com and they have a demo on there.
One X.
And you can listen to the files, and you'll know. There's no doubt. Immediately, you can tell which is which, right? And then Lloyd brought some files over here that I'm going to see if we can put up on our website with the podcast.
That'd be great. Yeah.
And those files, you could really tell. I mean, even more so. And it's the equivalent of going from like AM radio to like a stereo. I mean, it's pretty drastic. And then you can't go back. Once you see the promised land, you can't go back. And I think that's a fantastic model about. Paying money, uploading, getting your stuff processed, and downloading.
Well, okay. So if you do that, you only have 90 seconds, right, to make your decision? Is that what you're saying? Or 90
seconds?
Approximately.
We haven't pinned that number down yet.
90 seconds to process? 90 seconds of the song?
No. You have 90 seconds is what we're talking about to determine what, your settings that you want to use for processing your...
So it gives you a 90-second sample.
Preview.
A preview of that. You dial it in, and then you process it.
Okay, yeah, but you can export then.
Right.
It'll process and send it back to you.
Right.
We don't pay extra for the export.
No. We don't store it on our website because if you decide to do your Beatles library, we don't want copyright issues.
No kidding.
So we don't store it.
Yeah.
We just put it there, process it, send it back to you.
Yeah.
But does everything have to, does it have to always go through you, or is it something that you're going to sell the technology? The reason I say that is I know that the film community is so paranoid about, and same even gaming community.
They truly are.
It's like they're not going to send any master anything anywhere for fear of being pirated.
You're talking about licensing, though.
For the film industry, we're talking about at this point building basically a black box
that the studio has. They run it through it and transfer.
Right. And we license that.
Yeah.
Or for games. This would be wonderful for games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. Well, especially when I heard it, iOS games. Because usually by the time they're compressed and coming down your phone, they sound like they're compressed and coming down your phone. Yeah. You know? And so you use a technology like this.
Adobe, Microsoft, Apple.
I mean, it's pretty phenomenal. And it's definitely, like I said, I heard it. And you will – there's a big difference, you know? I don't know what kind of voodoo magic you guys do, but like I said, it's really amazing. I love that. Like the model, though, makes a lot of sense because even if you only have 90 seconds, if it's cheap enough, you're gonna probably master one and you're going to take it and you're going to live with it for a while. And if you need to make a change or something, then just do it again. And if it's cheap enough, then it's just like, okay, let's go to version 2 or let's go to version 3 or whatever.
Well, if you don't like what happened in that 90 seconds, you can do it again. It's not like it kicks you out.
Well, the thing is, though, is I know a lot of musicians, like, will make a mix, and then they have to live with it. They got to, like, before they get released. I'll tell you who does that is Martin. Martin, he'll have his album, and he'll live with it and the master for,
but you can't take that,
weeks.
Render it, save it, then do another one slightly different, render it, save it.
Oh, yeah.
Save it as multiple.
Yeah, exactly. If it's cheap enough.
Version 1, version 2.
Exactly. You can just version it out as many times as you want.
And plus we have what our chairman calls the Happy Meal deals, where maybe you pay for 10 and get 2 or 3 others for free.
That's
and you don't have to do it at one time.
Right. Now, let me ask you a question. In your website, are you going to be able to have an account and then keep track of what you did to what song so that if you want to do
– Most like, definitely.
I did 3 different versions. I liked version 2. I'm going to do my whole album version 2.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That kind of stuff. And then you go – let's say you do another album and like, I like what I did back there, you know, and so you can do your recalls and things like that.
Sure.
That in and of itself – you know what? That in and of itself could almost be a master in engineers, like little black box, right? Because they come to you in your studio and they pay you money to master. You come up with your own preset that's your preset.
Right.
And that has your sound.
Well, there
I'm going into a new business, boys.
there are some, there'll be several, I'll call them major engineers in the world that will have these machines. And they'll be sitting there for them, and they just use them all the time. One of them is here in L.A. His name is Mark Needham. He'll have one very shortly.
Have you guys done tests on broadcast TV and what it does to broadcast?
In fact, for the people that listen to this or in the right market areas, I just finished 6 episodes for JBTV, which is on NBC. It's a live concert broadcast on NBC on Saturday nights.
And we did, when AEG did the live poverty concert on September 29th, that was processed through Max Sound.
You know, we got to talk because I do a lot of brand commercials, you know, like some of my clients, like Toshiba and stuff like that. I'd be curious how that would sound on some of the commercials that I do, just regular, normal commercials. That would be awesome, especially like I just finished one that, there was a volcano, and we wanted to get a lot of really good rumble low end on it and stuff. And hearing what your box can do, that could definitely make it pop. All kinds of things.
You're seeing gold.
I just think it's anytime you can make something better. Here's the deal, all right? And you know this. A lot of times, what separates the men from the boys is little tricks, little secrets, little things that you do. It's what you can bring to the table. right? If you're out there and you're a commercial mixer and you have a client and you can get a process that can make your stuff sound better, I mean, just better, then you want to take advantage of that because that
people
are
going to
come to you.
Can you like
– Oh, yeah. All the time. And listen, this is not –
I got a project coming up.
This – I have two – we have two presets we use 90% of the time. But when we work with a producer or somebody, we're not there to be the arrogant assholes and say, hey, we're going to make your stuff sound better.
Right.
We're going to be the guys that sit there and say, we're going to do our stuff to get the sound you want, the way you want it on your project.
And you guys are in Texas, though.
No, we're here in Santa Monica.
Santa Monica.
Wow. My head's just buzzing. I mean, like.
Now, one of the cool byproducts of all this, how many of you guys have had your iPod or whatever in your earbuds in your ear and maybe for an hour and take them off and your ears are ringing?
Sure.
Pretty common thing that happens. In the what we do wave shaping wise, so the waveforms, less ear fatigue and less of the ear ringing.
Wow. That's amazing.
Because we're reshaping, you know, when you make an MP3, of course, you're squashing the waves down. And you're squaring some of it off, right?
You know what would be that would be good for? Studio headphones for cue systems.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's, I mean, the applications are endless. Yeah. Anything to do with sound and audio.
Wow.
It can be an improvement.
Wow.
Or a game changer.
So what do you want to, you know, so where are we at right now with the MaxD process? Should people start be looking out for that website to go up pretty soon? Are you still in negotiation?
In the next 3 months, it'll be up. That part where you can do your sound yourself. Right.
And then you're saying the iOS app's going to be coming out pretty soon.
Right.
For your iPhone and your whatever iDevice you have.
Right.
Which and I can't wait because then you'll be able to play all your iTunes music and all through it. And that's what's amazing.
And people are already enjoying it on the Android.
I know. I saw that too. And I didn't have any music on my Android devices. It's all on my iOS. But I can only imagine. Because that's when you can live with it and you hear the difference because people know what their library sounds like. And
right.
And so that's pretty amazing. That's going to be phenomenal. Well, hey, we're running short on time. Anything you want to say to wrap it up or wrap up MaxD or anything? I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, I've heard it. Bobby's heard it.
Yeah. Just – watch for us. We're about to be everywhere.
I heartily endorse it.
That's me too. It's really cool.
One of the big things about this is that we want to help people in the world. So I go down and what's the place next to us where the bodybuilder guys are?
Venice.
Gym.
Venice.
We go down there on the weekends. We see these little guys with their really bad sounding CDs trying to hand them out to people. And people know
right.
they sound bad.
Right.
I want to give that guy a chance to have his CD sound great, and it doesn't cost him $50,000.
Yeah.
It costs him less than $100. And his CD sounds awesome. Once it's on his master, he can copy it as many times as he wants. It's still on there. Everybody will be able to afford it.
Cool.
Wow.
And with that.
Well, hey, Lloyd. John, thank you so much for joining us here on the Audio Now.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I mean that was fun. I mean that was really fun. I mean MaxD is an amazing process. You guys did some great work back in the day. Thank you. You made my job easier when I was a keyboard tech, and it was awesome. This whole thing was awesome. Before we go. Really quick. Well, first of all, Bobby, you up to anything that you...
Yeah, I always have too many projects going at the same time. Several book projects. I got a 5-1 mixing project coming up. So I'm busy.
It's cool. Scott, I know you're... we cannot talk about it, but I know you're doing some stuff we cannot talk about.
There's a trailer of a project I'm working out that comes out in 2 weeks that's tied to The Hobbit. And it has... robots and creatures, so look out for it.
Okay.
you'll see it. Yep. You won't miss it.
And Rob?
Yeah.
I know you're working because you have that look like, I'm working.
I'm working, all right. Well, I don't know how much I've said about the project I'm doing here on the East Coast, but it's going well and going to wrap up soon. But I've been producing a band in Austin. I theoretically live in LA, but haven't been there for a while. But so I also just finished up, I think we finished up a video game project with Mr. Gershon's company.
Which they finished at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yikes. And it's been going on since what? The beginning of the year? It's been a long time. But it looks like that's just about wrapped up. And there's just a whole heck of a lot going on. But I can't wait to see you guys in person again.
Yeah.
It's great because sometimes I'll wake up at 4 a.m. and I'll just be like, oh, I don't know. So I'll go online and the composer and Rob and everybody's communicating all through the night.
It's crazy. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I'm gonna miss it slightly.
Not.
That's great. That is awesome.
How about you, Mike?
Well, I have kidsleep.com, which is children's stories that I produced. Actually wrote and directed and did some talent on the stories, which by the time this post should be up and running. So that'll be pretty cool. It's bedtime stories for your kids that you can play on your iDevice or on your Android device. And
it should have Max D on it.
Hey, believe me, I'm already thinking there. But it's really cool. We've done 2 episodes. We're going to do a ton more. And it has its own podcast and everything. So it'll be really fun. It's for parents and stuff like that. So that's taken a lot of time. And then just working on some branding commercials and things like that. And funny enough, make some viral videos for the project that Scott can't talk about. So I will not talk about it either. But it seems like...
Am I the only guy that doesn't work in that project?
I know. Because Brandon's working on that project,
yeah,
too.
Right.
Well, I think we can save the name, though, can't we? At this point? Yeah, you know what? 2 weeks.
You go ahead.
No, 2 weeks we'll make the announcement.
All right, we'll do it in 2 weeks.
When's this podcast come out?
Probably in 2 weeks, because we still have to post the podcast we did 2 weeks ago. So,
you know, it's funny. You may be the only one not working on this because we're going to Todd AO to talk to someone about that tomorrow.
Well, somebody hire me then.
All right. Well, anyhow, well, hey, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And once again, lay off Bobby, okay? He likes Apple products. I just want to let everybody know that.
Okay, but at the very least, go check out my blog, bobbyosinski.blogspot.com.
I just unscribed, you know.
Hey, well, not only your blog, but – you know, if you don't follow Bobby on Twitter, he has a good Twitter account. He posts little nuggets now and then that I really like.
At Bobby Osinski, yeah.
So, all right. Well, from myself and from all the guys, thank you, Lloyd. Thank you, John, for joining us. And you guys have a good holiday season, and we'll catch you guys next time. Bye-bye.
For listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.